This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Well, today's the day, at least with regard to the Pennsylvania primary. Today's a day with regard to everything else that's going on in the world. I want to just give you a little bit of an update on what I think, frankly, is going to be one of the biggest issues that we are going to be dealing with over the next presidential term, and perhaps for as much as a generation, you know, for as much as 10, 20 years here, and that is this incredible, disastrous, worldwide economic mess that Reaganomics has brought the United States and the world, as Reaganomics and Thatcheronomics have spread across the world and have been shoved down the throats of countries by the IMF and World Bank. The so-called neoliberalism is how it's referred to in Europe. Here, we simply call it Reaganomics or voodoo economics. And then I want to get into asking the question, and I'm frankly puzzled by the polls, and so I'm very interested in getting your take on whether either of the campaigns have hit so far below the belt that there's no turning back. And I'll explain that in just a minute. First, I just want to share this with you. This is there's no and by the way, just to give you a heads up on the show today, in our second hour, Richard North is going to be on here. He's spent 4 years in the European Parliament as a research director for Westminster. He works with Christopher Booker. These are names that are very well known in the UK. And basically, his position is that, you know, we're scaring ourselves to death unnecessarily. In this case, with things like global warming and BSE and asbestos and whatnot. And it should be a lively debate. In our third hour, this is going to be fascinating. In our third hour, the ambassador to Finland, friend of Bernie Sanders, Pekka Lintu, is going to be with us. And we'll be discussing, you know, how life is in Finland as opposed to the United States and why. Jim Hightower is going to drop by at the bottom of the third hour, and Congressman Arl Blumenauer from Oregon is going to be with us at the very end of the third hour. So that's our day today. Now, two things from the Financial Times that I want to share with you. Just, you know, first of all, this screaming headline: UK offers to acquire mortgage securities. This is a desperate act by the Bank of England, and they point out in the article that the Fed, the Bank of England is the, you know, the equivalent of the Fed here, and they have made an unlimited offer to acquire the mortgage bank securities of UK banks. In other words, they're saying to all the banks in England, if you've got a bunch of bad paper on your books, if you've got a bunch of these loans that are ultimately probably going to be worth very, very little, we will buy them from you. Now, there's a haircut involved. In other words, there's a discount. It's 27%, but we'll buy them from you. So your liabilities, you're going to have some liabilities, but they're going to be absolutely limited. And the Fed is looking at maybe doing the same thing. What this says to me is, you know, when a Federal Reserve Bank steps in and says, okay, we will take on these kind of liabilities, what they're saying is that they realize that the market itself, that is the private banks, can't deal with it. That that it's beyond their capability, which means it's far worse than we thought. Which is why it is, you know, a 24-point, well, actually maybe 16-point type, or 22, yeah, it's 24-point type headline, big screaming, you know, inch and a half, inch tall headline in today's Financial Times. The lead story: UK offers to acquire mortgage securities. Bank of England in $100 billion liquidity push. What they're trying to do is they're trying to make sure that the banks will continue loading money, because they know if the banks don't continue loading money, then you have what is known in banking circles as a liquidity crisis. We're experiencing the leading edge of it right now. No, it's not the trailing edge. It is the early edge of it. And the last time in the United States we had a serious liquidity crisis in using banking speak, it was referred to in the general press as the Republican Great Depression of 1929 and the 1930s. And in fact, the sovereign wealth fund of Singapore, it's referred to as the Government of Singapore Investment Corporation, or GIC, has come out and said, holy cow, guys, there's something really scary going on. Please do something, somebody. Now, that's obviously my words, not theirs. This John Burton in Singapore writing in today's Financial Times, the world is teetering on the edge of the worst recession for a generation. According to the Government of Singapore's Investment Corporation, the world's third largest sovereign wealth fund. Now, here is an actual quote from Mr. Tan, the executive director of the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Singapore, the third largest in the world, the GIC. They have assets of over $300 billion, a third of $1 trillion in assets. He says, we could be facing a recession which is longer, deeper, and wider than any recession that we have encountered in the last 30 years. Now, why 30 years? Because that's as long as they've been looking at it in Singapore. That was when the Sovereign Wealth Fund was started in Singapore. So it could be even longer than that. In fact, he said the financial investment markets will be extremely nervous and volatile over the next 1 or 2 years. Instead of the rising tide, which has broadly benefited financial investment markets for the last 10 to 20 years, we are now facing choppy seas which could engulf the broader economy globally. He added the next few years may well be among the most challenging years for GIC since our establishment in 1981. 9 years ago now. So Singapore is scared. In the meantime, what's Japan doing? Well, Japan is being criticized for doing what we should have been doing all along. Get it. We bought into this Reaganomics, Tom Friedmanomics, Milton Friedmanomics, this crazy idea that, oh, it's a global economy. Let's just throw open all the doors. Let's let a country where labor costs 15 cents an hour have their labor compete with our labor here. Won't that be a wonderful thing? Well, it will be if you're the CEO of one of the largest corporations in the world, particularly one that manufactures products. But if you happen to work in the United States, now it means you're screwed. And the Japanese know this, and so they have not let it happen. The Japanese market all these years has been very, very closed. I remember back in the 70s, myself and a friend of mine here in New York, in fact, I'm staying in his apartment right now, my friend Jerry. We owned a company called Langley Sinclair Instrumentation Systems, and we were importing products from Japan, and as well as products that were manufactured down in Georgia, and low radiation CRTs. This was the early days of computers. We were buying full page ads in Byte magazine for people who were building their own computers and stuff like that, and we were selling computer parts. And I went over to Japan and I negotiated a number of deals with some fairly small Japanese companies and with one of the very largest of the Japanese companies. And in addition to learning a little bit of Japanese, arigato gozaimashita, and learning a little bit about how not to make a total fool of yourself with regard to protocol and customs and etiquette, one of the things that I learned is that if you're going to do business in Japan, you have to have a Japanese partner. If you're going to do business in Japan, particularly if you want to sell something in Japan, forget it. You really have to have not just a Japanese partner, but basically a Japanese owner. That the Japanese market was very close. They were more than happy to sell us product. And we bought a lot of product from them and sold it, through the mail, through our ads in the computer, do-it-yourself magazines. But so anyhow, here's the article, Mendelsohn attacks Japan's closed markets. This is the Peter Mendelsohn. He's the guy. He's the head of trade for the European Union. Okay. And Peter Mendelsohn said Japan was the most closed investment market in the developed world. That's a verbatim quote from him. The EU Trade Commissioner's stern words came after Tokyo rejected on national security grounds a proposal by the Children's Investment Fund. This is a UK activist fund to double its stake in J Power, an electric power wholesaler. Here's the bottom line. The Europeans, the Brits, want to invest in Japan. The Japanese are saying, no, we're not going to take your money. Now, in America, we're saying, hey, we'll sell you anything you want. You want to buy a bank? We'll sell you a bank. You want to buy a car company? We'll sell you a car company. You want to buy a power utility? We'll sell you a power utility. You want to buy a highway or a tollway and charge us money and take the profits back to France or Spain? No problem. Well, the Japanese are saying, no. Mr. Mendelson in Japan for an annual EU meeting suggested the country was taking advantage of other open economies while keeping its own shut. Well, gee, how about that? They're smarter than us. Anyhow, I'll wrap that up, and I want to get into this election stuff with you right after this. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, what a plan. Okay, two sentences and then I'm done with it. But I'm telling you, this is the thing that's going to affect our lives tremendously. And it's like we need to learn from the Japanese and the South Koreans and all the other really strong economies in the world. Frankly, the Chinese are doing the same thing right now. Their markets are very close to our products, relatively speaking. And here, Peter Mandelson, the EU trade chief, he said, and I quote, this is just... He says, for every dollar Japan invested in the UK and Netherlands, European companies were able to invest a net total of only 3 cents in Japan. So Japan is saying, yeah, you want to sell us your companies? We'll buy them. You want to sell us your roads? We'll buy them. You want to sell us your banks? We'll buy them. You want to buy our banks? Say what? Okay. The voting machines are already breaking down in Pennsylvania. Machines malfunctioning, Sam Wood reports. Readers Inquirer reporters attempting to cast ballots this morning found long lines across the region created by broken machines. This election is going to be done, I believe, 100% on electronic voting machines that produce no paper trail, no possibility of an audit. Governor Ed Rendell thinks it's just a fine thing, thank you very much, that our vote has been privatized. What are you, crazy, Ed? Anyhow, just my opinion. But beyond that, the question that I'm really curious about, and I'd like to just toss this conversation open for this, is has the Beltline been breached? And let me explain what I'm talking about. There was a book published back in the late 60s, early 70s, called The Intimate Enemy. And it was the first good popularization, and it's now become just a normal part of couples counseling and psychotherapy and whatnot, but particularly couples counseling. It was the first good popularization of a concept that until then had not been widely known by the general public, but was known to most therapists, which is that we all have what you could call a belt line, below which, if you kick somebody or hurt somebody, they are really, really hurting. I mean, the obvious physical metaphor is, you know, you kick somebody below the belt line, you know, ouch! Whereas, you know, you punch him in the chest or something, they hit him in the arm, something like that. It's okay, you know, so I've been hit. What's the big deal? And what happens in relationships, here's the relationship part of it. What happens in relationships is that in fairly short order, typically within a matter of a few months, certainly within a year or two of a relationship becoming significant and meaningful, not only do you discover the things that the other person likes and all the quirks about their personality, et cetera, et cetera, you also discover where their belt line is. That is, you discover the things that uniquely will wound them if you say them or if you do them. I mean, there are things that I know that I can say to Louise that will really and truly hurt her. And she knows things that she can say to me that will really and truly hurt me. We both know each other's weaknesses. And we've been married 35 years. So you learn this stuff. And therefore, neither one of us ever says those things. You fight, you argue, you debate, you get passionate, you put out your position, but you never go back to the, oh, you're just like your mother, or whatever it may be, you know, whatever the person's belt, and it could be something very trivial. It could be, you know, making a fun of, you know, a person's nose or something. I mean, whatever it is, we all have a belt line. We all have an area where we can be wounded. And in an intimate relationship, you never hit below the belt line. So here's the question. Have the Clinton or Obama campaigns hit below the belt line? In the debate the other night, when Hillary Clinton said, made reference not just to Jeremiah Wright, but then to Louis Farrakhan and to publishing a Hamas screed in a newsletter, the implication being that Barack Obama had something to do with that. I don't think he even knew about it. Was that hitting below the belt line? In my opinion, it was. And what I'm seeing, and you know, perhaps you have examples of Barack Obama hitting below the belt line. I frankly don't have any that come immediately to mind. But what I've been seeing over the last month and a half that concerns me so deeply is that 2 and 3 months ago, Carl Wolfson and I were just talking about this on KPOJ, is that 2 or 3 months ago, I have friends who run some of the more progressive websites out there, who some of whom have become fairly outspoken and out there Clinton partisans, and some of whom have become fairly outspoken and out there Obama partisans. And 2 months ago, they were talking above the beltline stuff. They were talking about differences in policy, who has more experience, who might be more electable, who's going to be a better leader for the country, those kind of things. Now what I'm hearing from them, in many cases, is below the beltline stuff. Is the kind of stuff that is designed to really, truly wound, to take a person down, to make a person unelectable. And my concern is that if Democrats, see, this goes way beyond Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment, thou shalt not speak ill of another Republican. It is a variation on that, a subtle one perhaps, but I think the most important one, which is thou shalt not hit below the belt line. And I think this is what provoked Michael Moore to come out yesterday and endorse Barack Obama, was that he clearly, in his opinion, thought that the Clinton campaign had hit below the belt line. And the problem is, once you've done that, not only do you wound the other person, like in a relationship, but you may wound that person's ability to win the general election. So have the two campaigns, have either of the campaigns hit below the belt line. What's your take?
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270.
Well, maybe if Barney Frank has his way. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by Teamsters for Change. Time for change in Washington. Find out more at Teamster.org. And my Barney Frank reference to the I'm a toker. Barney has introduced legislation to decriminalize pot, at least at the federal level, and allow medical marijuana, allow the states to do medical marijuana. And I salute him for it. I think it's a fine thing. I believe Ron Paul's on that as well. Anyhow, here's the issue. And let me just put it out. My take on it is that the Clinton campaign has hit below the belt. And the Obama campaign, in my opinion so far, has not hit below the belt, but perhaps you can convince me that they have. If you can show me a point where they have wounded Senator Clinton in a way that would prevent her from getting elected in the general election, I would like to hear that, because I think that subtle distinction is the one that we need to be making. And this is frankly my concern. My take on this is that, you know, we're, as Carl was pointing out to me this morning, Carl, who's got a master's degree in political science and knows all things political, in Carter's election, you know, Carter versus Reagan, when they ran up to the running up to the campaign, Carter had that thing locked up in June or July. He had the delegates. He had enough delegates. It was a done deal. When they went into the convention, Teddy Kennedy comes and he says, so let's change the rules. Literally, let's change the rules. Let's change the way that we count delegates. And I'm hearing that now from the Clinton campaign. Let's change the rules. Let's look at the popular vote. Well, looking at the popular vote is a fancy way of saying let's ignore all the caucus states, because you don't have as many people voting in a caucus as you do in a state that has a primary. So it's like, let's change the rules. And the consequence of that arguably below the belt bashing, or that fight that happened between Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy, was in part that Ronald Reagan became elected president of the United States, a guy that at the time everybody thought, there's no chance. This guy's a nutcase. Look at what he did in California. He shut down free public education in California. He harmed the state. He's a total crazy. That was the widespread perception of Ronald Reagan, right up until 3-4 months before the election. And it took them, well, who knows who did it. I'm of the opinion that the Reagan campaign played a role in it, but nonetheless, it took the Iran hostage crisis to even then for Reagan to win the election. But the point is that Carter was wounded by that. Has a wounding occurred now that has taken us beyond a point of no return, or that at least has done so much damage that it's going to be very difficult for anybody to recover from? John in Scottsdale, Arizona, listening on KPHX.
Yeah,
hey, John.
I am in pain. I'm an African-American patriot, and I'd like to ask you a question about ads in this campaign. Now, Tom, you know and I know that if you burn down the entire house, the kitchen is likely to go up in flames with it. And I want to direct your attention to this recent ad by the Clintons. You may not know about it, but it's an attack ad against Obama, which features Osama bin Laden.
Right. It's called, in fact, the title
Obama
of the...
That features Osama bin Laden.
And I know.
This is in addition to the racially tainted advertisements that the Clintons have aired in the past. That's painful.
I think it's inappropriate. I think it's wrong. I think it's a below the belt hit. I mean, on top of that, you've got that church out there. Drudge is featuring a photo now of this church where they've got a sign out front that says Obama or Osama.
Right.
Are
if
they
you
brothers?
Burn down the house, you're going to take the kitchen with it. And a lot of blacks, I believe, are in Americans. What good thinking Democrat would accept that kind of a campaign?
Yeah,
you burn down the house, you're going to lose that infamous kitchen.
I agree, John, and I think that this is a terrible mistake that is being made by the Clinton campaign, and I think it's a mistake that is not only going to harm Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton if either one of them is the nominee in the fall, but over the short term is going to blow up in their faces.
That's my bullet. Thanks,
yeah.
Tom.
Thanks a lot, John. Bruce in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. You're a poll watcher in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
What are you seeing?
I'm sorry?
What are you seeing?
Well, I just saw a woman who said that she hoped that Barack Obama kicked Hillary's butt. So if her sentiment about hitting below the belt, was literal,
isn't that a shame? I mean, it should be, okay, I just voted for this guy or I just voted for this woman because I think that they're the best candidate, and I'm very proud of that, rather than I want to go out and take them down.
Yeah, well, that was just one. Most of them are mostly the Obama voters are the smiling, most spirited ones giving me a thumbs up because I'm a veteran for Obama, and they have sympathy for the veterans and sympathy for vets for Obama.
Yeah. As a poll watcher, are you seeing shenanigans?
No.
Good.
A couple of days ago, our office paid $100 to some woman who said that somebody tore down her grade school kids' signs in front of the school and put up Obama signs. Now, I don't know who the heck could have done that. Sounds like a dirty trick to me.
Yeah.
But, that's
the kind of thing that happens in politics, though. I mean, Bruce, thanks for the call and for the point. Welcome to the wonderful world of politics. I'm talking about stuff that's being done by the candidates and by the campaigns themselves. Joanne in Seattle. Joanne, you think that Obama has hit below the belt?
I think that Obama came in hitting below the belt. He rode in on Republican talking points against the Clintons.
For example?
For example, that the Republicans were the party of ideas. For example, that Reagan was a transformative president.
Reagan was a transformative Republican,
and
for the worse.
And specifically saying, and Clinton was not. So from the very end, talking about how he had capitalized on the excesses of the 60s. The other thing that I feel that they did that was really not fair and not good, not good in the sense that you're talking about, was to smear the people such as Geraldine Ferraro who are not racist and their remarks were not racist. It was obvious that they had to distort a lot of things that were said by the Clinton campaign to get that read. By this time, it's a different picture. But that post, that role that he has been playing of this morally superior candidate, condemns him to be unreconcilable, and that is what I think was below the belt.
Okay, so this, Joanne, you know, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Here now, let's take this to an even larger frame. Yesterday, I think it was, or perhaps it was the day before yesterday, I shared with you Ralph Nader's polling, which indicated that at least in Michigan, which obviously a state where there's a lot of sour grapes, shall we say, over how things have gone down in the Democratic primary, and justifiably so, let me add, that as many as 17% of voters are saying that if their candidate, Obama voters are saying if it's not Obama, Clinton voters are saying if it's not Clinton, if their candidate is not the Democratic nominee, they're going to vote for Ralph Nader. Do you think, and are you, as a Clinton supporter, are you to the point, as a result of what you perceive to be below the belt hits by the Obama campaign, to the point where if Obama's the nominee, you won't be able to vote for him?
Oh, no, not at all. And I would have hoped that his campaign would have left his supporters feeling as I do. I think it's imperative that we get a Democratic win, and I think Obama is quite wonderful. I am not meaning to imply that he's a bad person. I'm saying that, in answer to your question, his entire campaign has been below the belt.
Okay. So you think that the campaign itself has wounded Hillary Clinton to the point that the average American would not vote for her for president?
Well, that they would not like to, and that that's the only thing he was running on. He is running on his moral superiority. It condemns her to be morally inferior.
Yeah, I suppose if you say I am good, it implies the other person is
no,
ill,
no. But I am a better, a morally superior person.
Yeah. Okay. I haven't, you know. Well, okay. Joanne, point made, and I'm not gonna debate you about it.
I
understand your perspective, and thank you very much for the call, Chris in Eugene, Oregon. You want to take the other side of this?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air, Chris.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you. Wow. That just kind of blew me away, because I certainly don't see that. And I'm trying to be objective, and I'm an Obama supporter, first of all, but I loved Bill and Hillary. I supported Bill through the hard times. I wouldn't read any of the trash. I stayed above the fray. I didn't wallow in it so that I could defend him. And I did. And
I was there, too. I think I was one of the early donors to MoveOn.org back when everybody was going, what is this thing?
I was on the ground floor of MoveOn.org, and now apparently there are some issues with Hillary and that organization. But so I've seen it from both sides, and I get emails from both camps. I do not get the emails from the Obama camp that I get from the Clinton camp. And I don't understand the previous caller's point of view, and I'm sure that it is politics. I expect to see them, you know, smacking each other on issues, but I
okay,
do
well,
believe
here's the $64,000 question, Chris. She said that although she's a Clinton partisan, she would vote for Obama if he was the nominee.
Yeah.
You're an Obama partisan. Would you vote for Clinton if she's the nominee?
See, that's really hard, and I don't want to be an idiot here, and my husband and I have talked a lot about this. He absolutely will. I will hold my nose and vote for her, but I won't be happy. I think the wounder has wounded herself. I mean, they're both, the wounder and the woundee both carry scars. And for me, I just wouldn't be happy. I wouldn't be as supportive. I just couldn't be excited.
Yeah, this is the problem with negative campaigning. Chris, thank you very much for the call and for your thoughts and sharing them with us. This is the problem with running a negative campaign, and particularly with a anything goes negative campaign. And it seems to me increasingly that we're inching in that direction in this Democratic primary, which is exactly what the Republicans want. Nobody else wins.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
No, increasingly it's not. Welcome back. By the way, it's Earth Day today. A great day to pick up a copy of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. It's just out in DVD. It is brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant. Narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio, produced by Leonardo DiCaprio. A number of just extraordinary folks in this movie. It's my BuzzFlash book of the month, Independent Thinker's book of the month. It's $5. $5 for this thing. And, you know, plus shipping and handling, it's $11.50 over at BuzzFlash. That supports their efforts, but you can buy it you can buy it pretty much anywhere. So let me say, there's a lot that we can do for Earth Day. One of the most important things we can do is educate ourselves and educate others. In the 11th hour, this DVD is one of the best tools to do that. Absolutely. Diane, Olympia, Washington. Hey, Diane, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I've been a long, long time listener. Hey, I'm a Democrat that's in the demographic of the over 50 Caucasian women.
Mm-hmm.
And this weekend I attended our county Democratic convention, which I haven't done for years, many years. I was in 68. I got to see Robert Kennedy speak, and he fired me up and made me feel inspired about life. And Barack Obama is exactly like that, in not just the emotion, but the mental idea. It's not just an emotional response to this man. He is so dignified and so serene and so intellectual, and at the same time, he is so calm and honest. And Hillary comes across now to me as shrill, sanctimonious, and dishonest, and I never thought I'd say that. I sent her $60 when she ran for the Senate. But I think she's become a pseudo. Hello?
Yeah, no, you're still in the air.
I think she's become a pseudo Democrat. Number one, I was against her when she voted for the war. I wasn't going to vote for her in a primary at all or in a caucus. But I was an Edwards supporter, and then I jumped on board Obama, and I'm so happy I did.
But, Diana, first of all, let me say, let's be careful not to use Republican frames. When those Democrats in the Senate, and it was a majority of the Democrats in the House voted against that resolution to authorize force in Iraq, but the ones in the Senate, when they voted for that, that resolution specifically said that George W. Bush had to allow the inspectors to play out their course with the U.N., and he didn't. And it specifically said that he had to certify to Congress that there was a connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11.
But she's never apologized for that vote. And it's not just the war vote. It's the NAFTA thing. And it's billed 800,000 speaking fees in South
America. Okay,
so
let's add it all up, Diana. I guess the bottom line is, if Barack Obama's the nominee, obviously you're going to vote for him. If Hillary Clinton is the nominee, will you vote for her? Will you vote for Ralph Nader? Will you stay away from the poll? And, well, first of all, let me ask you that question.
Both my husband and I will either stay away or vote for Ralph Nader.
And
because
when did you
for a Republican light.
No, I understand. And please understand that by doing so, you're essentially voting for John McCain.
I know, but sometimes you have to hit bottom before we start getting better in this country.
At what point did you reach, when did you reach that point, Diana?
When she said, "Shame on you, Barack Obama," that was it.
So it was about a month ago.
Oh, well, I wasn't going to vote for her anyhow. But, I mean, in the general, I would have. But when she started doing this character assassination, and she piled it on so hard, I thought she's lost all integrity. And, like I said, I sent her $60 when she ran for the Senate. Yeah. But now I know she is not Eleanor Roosevelt.
Well,
and that's
at least she's not. At least to many folks, she's not behaving like such. And, Diana, thank you for sharing with us. I guess then the next question becomes, can a candidate redeem themselves if they are perceived by the voters to have stepped over a line? Because I think that Hillary Clinton has a lot of positives. I think Barack Obama has a lot of positives. In any case, Dave in West Palm Beach, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. Great pleasure to hear from you.
Thank you.
Listen, as an ultra moderate, I have to say that liberals and Democrats have to toughen up a little bit. To play politics in the big leagues, you've got to be able to take a black eye. I mean, anybody that's watched the Adams series on HBO has seen that this goes back 200-plus years.
But so that was against parties. Jefferson was an anti-federalist. Adams was a federalist. That was the equivalent of the Democrats and the Republicans.
Okay,
Jefferson created the what was then called the Democratic-Republican Party, which is today's Democratic Party. Adams was a member of the Federalists, which is were the heirs of today's Republican Party. They were not on the same side. And that's my point. With, you know, I think Reagan was right, you know, with his 11th commandment, thou shalt not speak ill of another Republican. He wasn't saying don't attack another Republican. He was saying don't hit them below the belt.
Alexander Hamilton, who was a Federalist, I mean, he had papermen in his pocket. And, I mean,
Hamilton ended up in a duel.
I mean, yeah,
I mean, the times were different.
I understand that with Burr, but I mean, he
died
said,
as a result of going off half-cocked.
He said the same thing about John Adams. I mean, there were Federalists that were stabbing George Washington, the man that basically founded this country.
But see, Washington was, you know, in large part. And first of all, I would not look to this documentary as an accurate history of the
times.
No,
but anybody who has studied history, and I have, it's not that far off. I mean, it's
no, other
it's
than the fact good. that it dramatically diminishes. Thank you, David. Dramatically diminishes John Adams' role in the Alien and Sedition Acts, which were the singular defining point of his presidency and the reason people threw him out of office, and B, his use of the XYZ affair to gin up fear for political purposes. But that's a whole other thing. Stick around. We'll be right back. Is fear being used against us?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, are we being frightened to death? What's more appropriate, to be afraid of something that kills, say, a half million Americans a year? Tobacco? Or somebody who killed 3,000 Americans once 7 years ago, Osama bin Laden? Or carbon dioxide? Richard North is with us. Richard has spent 4 years in the European Parliament as research director for a political group, now works as a political researcher for Westminster members of Parliament.
Yes.
Yeah, pardon my mangling this.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it?
Yeah, you also, with Christopher Booker, the well-known Sunday Telegraph journalist, have written three previous books, The Mad Officials, Castle of Lies, The Great Deception. You're the co-author at the popular blog eureferendum.blogspot.com. And you have a new book out that you are promoting, Scared to Death, From BSE to Global Warming, Why Scares Are Costing Us the Earth. So what are we scared of?
Well, really nice to talk to you, Tom.
Thank you, Richard. And the same.
The point we tried to get into the book, and its subtitle is From BSE to Global Warming. But what we're talking about is the scare as a social phenomenon, the use of fear to promote political agendas, and if you like, an institutional cue jumping, a method of using fear to put your agenda on the program and to force governments, and in fact government's very much part of it, but to force governments to spend money that otherwise on a more rational debate and a more careful clinical examination of the issues would not warrant the expenditure. So we don't disagree that there are all sorts of problems, all sorts of threats, but what happens in the scare mechanism is you very often have a real threat, a real problem, but then it is grossly exaggerated or taken out of proportion, and then expenditure, public policy get diverted to the detriment of good public policy and careful expenditure over a wide range of problems.
But isn't there very much the antithesis of that as well? I mean, I'm looking at your eureferendum.blogspot.com blog, and it's an excellent blog. And you've got on here a picture of your co-author, Mr. Booker, along with Fred Singer. Fred Singer's the guy who, in a Newsweek, this is 2007 Newsweek cover story,
Quoting from them, in April 1998, a dozen people from the denial machine, including the Marshall Institute, Fred Singer's group, and Exxon, met at the American Petroleum Institute's Washington headquarters to propose a $5 million campaign, according to a leaked eight-page memo, to convince the public that the science of global warming is riddled with controversy and uncertainty. And this is a guy who's in bed with Exxon.
Hang on, Tom, and that's different from Al Gore wanting to spend $300 million? I mean, the nature of the game is projecting information. The one thing that we're not scared of and, in fact, embrace is debate. Yet, when you look at the big, what we would call a scare running global warming, that the warmists will push as their primary agenda the fact that the debate is over, that there's no room for argument. Well, science was never like that, and good public policy has never been like that. The whole basis of democracy and the whole basis of science is about debating the issues. And the moment somebody turns around to you and say that there should not be debate and then resort to another insidious tactic, which I've seen so many times, is instead of addressing the issues, they attack the person. It's always ad hominem attacks, and my goodness, have I seen this. I've been.
But Fred Singer, actually, let me defend myself for an ad hominem against Fred Singer. I mean, the fact of the matter is that he is one of the most thoroughly debunked of the global warming deniers, and he's one of the most openly embracing of the oil industry.
I would so what? I mean, for goodness sake, if you look.
So at least we know the agenda. You've got ExxonMobil, which is now the most profitable corporation in the history of the world, going back to the Roman Empire, funding programs that will enhance their profit. Don't you think people legitimately should be skeptical of the words that come from those people?
The truth of it is that, in fact, big business is turning out to be a major beneficiary of the global warming scare. And by and large, you find big business, certainly over in Europe, actually supporting it. But on the other hand, if you look at the environmental groups, and I can't talk for the United States, but I can talk for Europe, within a very contentious policy area, the European Union pays 13 million euros a year to environmental groups to promote global warming and the global warming scare. Now, everybody's in this game. The whole of society works on money, that people attract funding.
But what if it's
not
real?
An issue. What matters is the quality of their
own. But what if it's real? What if it was real that asbestos actually kills people? What if it was real
asbestos
that
does kill people? Asbestos is a very, very serious problem, and this is the dynamic that we're writing about.
But you attack in your book the whole idea of having a scare around asbestos.
No, what we attack is that you take a basic, serious threat, which was a life-threatening problem for a small subsection of people, and then you grossly exaggerate the threat into a different area with a different product. So it's the difference between blue asbestos, brown asbestos, and white asbestos, and you link in white asbestos, which is actually harmless. It is chemically very similar to talcum powder you probably have in your bathroom, and start creating a spurious threat, and then spend a huge amount of money on dealing with something where the money could and should be spent elsewhere.
You know, my dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years.
Yep.
He died a year ago, June. I sat with him as he died, as he was puking his lungs out from mesothelioma, from asbestos. Four of the 12 guys that I knew who worked in that tool and die shop that I grew up with died of mesothelioma. They were using asbestos. All the steel came wrapped in asbestos. They were used asbestos to anneal metal. The asbestos scare is not a scare.
Look, this is the point we are making, Tom. We go back to the and we do. This is where we're perhaps slightly different from many, is we're looking at the social phenomenon. We start off with a series of very high profile food scares, and we look at eggs. And we find, yes, there was a germ of a threat. There was a serious, significant increase in food poisoning. But then it was focused on eggs, when in fact it was a multivariate causation of which eggs were the tiniest part. We then looked at a BSE, where, yes, nobody denies BSE was a major threat. It was of great concern, and my goodness, it did concern us. But then we had pundits arguing or predicting that 500,000 people were going to die each year, when all the evidence at the time, and I wrote at the time, suggested that this was going to be a very mild...
But Britain took very vigorous action to prevent that from happening.
I
mean, you guys slaughtered millions of animals to prevent BSE from spreading
and to prevent
those people from dying.
Of animals for absolutely no purpose, which at the time...
How do you know? How do you know they weren't infected?
Sorry?
How do you know they weren't infected? How do you know that they didn't stop the problem?
No, we know they didn't because I was involved in the process at the time. I was working with the industry, I was talking to the ministry, and I know...
Okay, here's perhaps the larger question. What are the things you detail, and you do a great job of detailing this social phenomena of, you know, let's all be afraid of something. I would submit to you that the exact same mechanism has been used by the Blair and Bush administrations with regard to terrorism, and that the fear of this is wildly overblown. I'm curious about your take on that, A... And B, if you think that this is just some basic part of human nature that we're never going to get away from, or is this some sort of manufactured consent?
Well, the point is that
and we have about a minute left. I'm sorry.
Yeah, to be scared is a survival trait.
Sure.
It is intelligent response to be concerned or scared about something that is unknown, is potentially threatening. What we're railing about is a deliberate use of fear as a tool to develop political agenda and to close down debate and to say there is no argument, you must accept us because you are going to die. And it's that mechanism that we're writing about.
So, if, for example, anybody in the United States who says, oh, you know, I'm not afraid of Osama bin Laden, gets shouted down. I mean, I'm frankly not afraid of him. I just don't think, you know, I'm not willing to change my constitution because of him.
The antidote to all of these is debate. And the moment somebody like Al Gore says, there is no debate, the science is settled, you know you're dealing with something different. You know you're dealing with a scare mechanism.
And a fascinating hypothesis. Richard North, your EU referendum.blogspot.com. His new book, Scared to Death, From BSE to Global Warming, Why Scares Are Costing Us the Earth. Richard, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks. Pleasure to talk.
Good speaking you. With you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You don't get out of vote this year, you're really not proven. It takes every one of us to keep the country moving. You can make it to the polls, you can get it together. Won't you meet me there, we'll vote, we can make things better. V-O-T-O.
Yeah, vote! That's what they're doing today in Pennsylvania, and to our listeners in Pennsylvania.
Get out there and vote.
I don't care who you vote for, just vote. Get involved. Well, actually, you know, I'm sure you care about who you vote for. I want you to be voting with intent, but let's get out there and vote. And of course, let's even take it a step beyond that. Voting is not enough anymore. It's just to be a citizen of the United States and say, well, I've done my civic duty, I've voted. I'm sorry, that's not enough. We have to be active. Speaking of Fred Singer and global climate change and all this kind of stuff, the Fortune 500 rankings are out, and the number two company, ExxonMobil.
No one's got no gasoline.
Come here, I'm going to eat you. I'm bigger than you, I'm higher in the food chain.
Oh, my. Well, number one on the Fortune 500 with revenues of around $378 billion, as I recall, was Walmart. They've been there for a long time. Yeah, $378 billion, $799 million. But they only showed a profit of $12 billion. On the other hand, ExxonMobil, number two on the Fortune 500, showed a profit of $40 billion. Dollars. Mind-boggling. $40 billion. Our ExxonMobil alert for the day. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Who hit below the belt? Should we be afraid? Are you afraid of Osama bin Laden? Are you afraid of international terrorists? I'm not. You know, our last guest, Mr. North, he's not afraid of global warming. That's fine. I am not. I wouldn't say I'm afraid of global warming, but I'm
I'm sufficiently concerned about it that I would like my tax dollars to be used to do something about it. I'm willing to pay more for that, and I think the public policy needs to be changed to do something about it. Obviously, I think the public policy needs to be changed to do something about terrorism as well. I think the thing to do, though, is to win the minds and hearts of people rather than bombing the hell out of them. We need another Marshall Plan. We need to be rebuilding the Middle East, not dropping bombs on them. Obviously, this is something that was completely lost on the Bush administration. Hopefully, the next administration, hopefully a Democratic administration, will get it. So, who are you going to vote for? Who are you afraid of? Harvey in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Harvey, what's up?
I'm doing good, Tom. Good. Thank you for having me on. And I want to touch on a couple of points, if I may. Speaking of below the belt, I think that any ad hominem attack is below the belt. Like you said, you should debate on policies and positions. Now, just for full disclosure, I'm a black man and I support Hillary. I think that the Obama campaign way back began the below the belt hitting when Michelle said that if you can't take care of your own house, how can you take care of the White House? That was below the belt.
That was an open appeal to race, and I think that that was a terrible mistake. Was it not? Don't you think she was saying, hey, if you're black, vote with us?
No. That was Michelle was referring to our bills, Piccadilly.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
And
your quote.
Hillary had something to do with that, of course. Maybe indirectly she did, but
yeah.
But point is, it was an ad hominem attack, and that's when it began. Of course,
yeah.
They were behind at that point, and of course, they had to do that, you know, to bring Hillary down.
I would condemn that as much as I would condemn some of the things that I think have been ad hominem attacks.
But I'd like to make another point also. Sure. But do you remember that?
I don't remember that particular quote, but I'll believe you that it was said.
I'm quite sure your listeners remember.
Sure.
Now the question is, will Democrats stay home? Well, we shouldn't. But the fact is, it's going to occur. To what degree, what percentage, it's going to occur. And in a close election, margins count. So if there are any superdelegates out there, I hope they hear this. Who will be hurt more if Democrats stay home? If blacks stay home in the red states that Obama carried, we're not going to switch to McCain. And guess what? We're not going to carry the red states anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, take Florida, for example.
So it sounds like you're making the argument that I was hearing from a very close African-American friend of mine back earlier in the campaign where he was campaigning for Edwards, in that he was saying, hey, wait a minute, the constituency of women for Clinton and of African-Americans for Obama is not large enough to carry the day. And plus, Edwards was a good progressive Democrat, so he was going for Edwards. I mean, that almost sounds like a micro-niching argument.
Well, what I'm saying is I think the superdelegates, and the rules of the Democratic Party is, if it gets to the point where the people had a chance and couldn't make a decision, then it's left to those superdelegates using whatever means and whatever are analytical means they have.
Yeah.
So I'm saying that it will hurt more if Hillary supporters stay home
than if Obama do. Harvey, we're out of time. We got to take this break here at the bottom of the hour. But you made your point and you made it well. Thank you very much for the call and thanks for listening to the show. Much appreciated. 27 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, our websites. Drop into our live chat room.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I don't mind you coming here and wasting all my time. 'Cause when you're standing out so near, I kind of lose my mind. Yeah.
Not the perfect. 34 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by you, our listeners.
You supporting the advertisers on the local radio station you're listening to, putting their bumper stickers on your car, letting them know that you're listening. Thanks so much for participating in our program. You can drop into our live chat room, by the way. TomHartmann.com will get you there. And also the new website, airamerica.com. 866-303-2270. Newly reinvented. And 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ian in San Francisco. Hey, Ian, listening to KGRN.
Hey, Tom, yeah. First of all, no matter whether it's Clinton or Obama who is nominated, I'll vote for the Democratic candidate. I don't really have any trouble with that. However, my position on what Clinton is doing now is I think she's fairly certain she's not going to get the nomination. And the reason is that there's almost no way. Well, there is, unless something just outrageous happens on the Obama side of the equation, he's going to have significantly more pledged delegates.
He's going to be within 100 delegates when all is said and done, unless she gets more than 20% of the vote in Pennsylvania and Indiana, which ain't going to happen.
So it's not going to happen. So he's going to have that. And in my opinion, and I think most Democrats would agree with this if they think about it, there's absolutely no way that the Democratic Party is going to nominate Hillary Clinton under those circumstances when there's a perfectly good African-American candidate who's won more pledged delegates.
Say when there's a perfectly good candidate, I don't think it matters what his race is. He's got more delegates than her. Now, the argument that her campaign is trying to make is if they can win big in West Virginia, if they can win big in Kentucky, if they can win big in Pennsylvania, and if they can, if they can pick up a couple of states, a half a dozen states, maybe even four or five of the larger states, then they might end up with a larger popular vote.
Well,
but that's going back to Ted Kennedy's thing of, well, let's change the rules of the game. And what makes me crazy is I never when these analysts go on TV, they say, well, should it be the popular vote? It's counting the popular vote means you are ignoring the caucus states.
Well,
and nobody's pointing that out.
My feeling is that and I think if you look at the math carefully, her purpose is not to win the nomination at this point, but instead to so damage Obama that there's no way he can win. Now, I don't think she's going to be successful.
You think that's so that she can run for president in 2012?
Yes, I think that's exactly what this is about.
See, I think that she is damaging herself so badly now that she will not be able to come back in 2012 and run.
Well, I agree with you that that's probably the case, and I don't think she's going to be able, and I think it's very frustrating for her at this point, able to damage Obama. He has a certain amount of that Teflon quality that is making it very hard for her to do this. She can't do it.
Well, and I would say that what that Teflon is, by the way, and it was the same thing with Ronald Reagan, is that both of them are staying above the fray. Both of them don't get into minutia arguments. They always take things to the bigger picture. And
Tom, the way you can tell that Obama is taking a higher road, when she does these things with Reverend Wright and this weather underground nonsense and this pushing all these little things, he could come back and say, because she's trying to make the point that he's not electable, and he could come back and say, well, what are you going to say when the Republicans, and we know they will, if you were the nominee, when they come out and say, talk about what happened in your White House with Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky.
Right, and so that would be hitting below the belt. But we had an earlier caller who said that Michelle Obama already raised that issue early on.
Well, not, but he has not. I mean, he may have raised that. She may have raised that once, but right in her face, he could have said that at this last debate.
Yeah,
he could have done it right in her face.
Yeah,
and he could have also said he could have run commercials with her talking about ducking down for cover as she went, in Bosnia, while at the same time showing the clips of her shaking hands with the little girl. I mean, that could have been the campaign commercial he would have done if he was going to do that.
Right. You're right, Ian. You're absolutely right. And that would be a below the belt campaign. Ian, thanks a lot for the call. Rick in Port Townsend, Washington, listening on KPTK Talk 1090. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Well, I want to say that I'm not afraid of Osama bin Laden, but I am afraid of John McCain. So
yeah.
I'm going to vote for whatever Democrat.
I will agree with you.
And as far as the Michelle Obama quote...
Actually, I'm afraid of who John McCain will nominate to the Supreme Court. That's the largest bottom line for me.
Or the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah, there you go.
The Michelle Obama quote, she was asked about that and said that she was talking about her family. Now, you can believe it or not believe it, but that was her explanation of that statement. So...
Okay, so it might have been somebody imagining a slur when none was intended.
Right, right. But what I really
but nonetheless, that did not become a soundbite that was pounded over and over and repeated over and over, as has happened on the other side.
Yeah, the thing I really want to talk about is the role of the Democratic Leadership Council in this whole thing. They're Hillary's staff. Are staffed heavily with those guys, and they came.
Well, her husband was one of the founders of it. But you know what's so ironic about the DLC is that the guy who heads it up right now, Harold Ford Jr., is the guy, an African American from, was it Tennessee or Kentucky? I think it was Tennessee,
right,
wasn't it? Who was actually ahead of the polls right up until two weeks before the election.
They
and
ran
his,
the Playboy commercial.
That's right. His white opponent runs an ad about, and Harold Ford actually did have a fundraiser at the Playboy Mansion, and they point that out, and then they have this white girl going, "Hey, Harold, call me," and boom, all the white racists came out, and he loses. And I don't get how, you know, Harold Ford Jr. and the DLC would be in any way behind any kind of negative campaign, particularly that might have a racial tinge to it.
Well, the reason I think is, well, I don't think they may not behind anything that has a racial tinge to it, but the complimenting of McCain, saying that McCain would be ready on day one and Hillary would be ready on day one.
Yeah.
I agree with the last caller that they are trying to cloud him in such a way that he'll lose the election, because if you look at it, they hate Howard Dean. So if Obama ran and lost, not only would he be out of the picture for the future, but they would blame Howard Dean.
You betcha.
Say what?
I said, you betcha.
Yeah. And so, you know, they look at it as killing two birds with one stone. And a lot of those guys are conservative Democrats. And so I think that if you scratch the surface and look at what's underneath, you'll see a lot of DLC stuff.
Yeah.
Because if Hillary's...
Well, I think you know, Rick. Let me just end it at that. I think and thank you for the call. I think you're going to see a lot of DLC stuff, in as much as you're going to see a lot of pro corporate Democrats in the Clinton campaign. But the reality is that there's a lot of pro corporate Democrats right through the Democratic Party. This is one of the reasons why I said it's not enough to just vote. We have to get active. We need to take this party back. People say, "Oh, you're just shilling for the Democrats." No, what I'm saying is something far more radical than support the Democratic Party. What I'm saying is we need to infiltrate and take over the Democratic Party. Progressives need to do with the Democratic Party what conservatives did with the Republican Party in the 1970s and 1980s. Take that thing over. It's a multi-billion dollar, actually, when you consider, you know, now the amount of money that's going into campaigns. Here's a billion-dollar machine. If you and I wanted to conspire to take over General Electric, we couldn't do it. There's no way. You'd have to raise billions of dollars to take over General Electric or take over Disney or, you know, one of the big media outlets, something like that. Something that could actually swing public opinion. Something that can actually change the political discourse in America. But there are two political parties out there where they're saying the doors are open, come on in, please take us over. All you have to do is show up. In my book, Screwed, the last chapter of the book is stories of three guys who just literally showed up and said, "Hey, you know, here in the local Democratic meeting, there's a bunch of fossils here. I'm going to bring in my friends and we're going to take this thing over." And they did, and they brought about real change. And I think that, you know, that's an important thing. Martha in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Martha.
Hey, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
Well, I'm calling from the belly of the beast, Michigan. Everybody likes to throw Michigan around a lot.
Yeah, my home state.
I can't hear you.
I said it's my home state. I was born in Grand Rapids, and I grew up in Lansing.
I know. Yeah. Oh, I know. Well, Michigan has been played around from the very beginning by the Clinton campaign, and I remember calling you when the day before our uncommitted vote and telling you how important that would be. And at the time, it was a stray cat say, "Maybe you should vote for Romney, and maybe people should vote for this, and, you know, DeCos is in on it. So the uncommitted vote, of course, has become very important in Michigan because, as we knew, Clinton came back and wanted to count that vote, and we fought it all fall and couldn't get our...
You know, that was a conspiracy theory 4 months ago.
No.
I mean, no, I'm serious. That's, you know, when people said, oh, Hillary is, she's not taking her name off the ballot because she's going to come back and say Michigan should be counted. People were saying, oh, no, come on. That's a conspiracy theory. It was just a paperwork screw up. She just forgot.
Well, I was working on the Edwards campaign at the time, but I'm fully on board with Obama now. I think what people are not realizing is what could happen to the movement aspect of this. If you don't have that passion, that movement, all those new registrations, I mean, come on, let's
They're all gone.
Pretend those are 50-50.
They're all gone. No, Martha, you're absolutely right. And that's my point. You know, we need to infiltrate and take over the Democratic Party the way the conservatives did the Republican Party and turn the party into a movement. Step by step, 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
Okay, I have the Michelle Obama quote here. This is really interesting. Media Matters did a whole piece on this. You can see it over at MediaMatters.org. She said, she was being interviewed on CNN, she said that one of the most important things that we need to know about the next president of the United States is he somebody that shares our values? Is he somebody that respects family? Is he a good and decent person? So our view was that if you can't run your own house, you certainly can't run the White House. So we've adjusted our schedules to make sure that our girls are first. So while he's traveling around, I do day trips. That means I get up in the morning, I get the girls ready, I get them off, I go and do trips. I'm home before bedtime. So the girls know that I was gone somewhere, but they don't care. They just know that I was at home to tuck them in at night, and it keeps them grounded. And the children, our children in our country, have to know that they come first. And our girls do, and that's why we're doing this. We're in this race not just for our children, but for all children. End of quote. Now, what Lisa Sylvester did on CNN was she then, out of that entire quote that I just read to you, she said, she pulled from that, quote, our view was that if you can't run your own house, you certainly can't run the White House, end of quote, and fed that to my colleague from Air America, Laura Flanders, and said, well, doesn't that sound like an attack on Bill Clinton? And Laura, hearing that out of context, said, well, yeah, it does. And as I would have if it had been fed to me out of context. And then CNN went on to do the same thing. Wolf Blitzer did the exact same thing with Donna Brazile. He fed her the out of context piece, but Brazile said, "Hey, wait a minute! I don't think she was taking a swipe at the Clintons or the Giulianis or anything else. I think she was trying to establish his credentials as a family person." And Blitzer says, "Well, you could read this and say maybe she's referring to Rudy Giuliani, who has a history of some problems." And no, don't think so. So, anyhow, Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, how are you doing? And today, of course, is the Pennsylvania primary, which I know you've been talking about.
Boy, oh boy, have we.
Lots cooking on the economic things, and that is the National Association of Realtors said that sales of existing homes fell a whopping 2% in 1 month in March. And so that is not great. Nancy Pelosi was fast on that this morning with a press release. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was with reporters this morning. And as you know, she's on this Iraq conference. And she said that the State Department specifically warned President Carter not to meet with Hamas, saying that it could confuse the message that the U.S. should not deal with Hamas. And, of course, Carter said that he never got any specific message.
Now, in addition to that, I'm reading the article about that in the Financial Times here. And just the first two sentences. Jimmy Carter, the former U.S. president, attempting to broker an understanding between Israel and Hamas, said yesterday the Islamist Palestinian group stood ready to accept the Jewish state as a neighbor and would back a peace deal under certain conditions. Mr. Carter said, I met with Hamas leaders from the West Bank, Gaza, and Damascus. They said they would accept a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders if approved by Palestinians, a departure from longstanding Hamas doctrine that refused to recognize two states.
That is exactly what I reported, as you recall, yesterday.
Right.
I read the Financial Times, and I agree. And what's so interesting is then Jimmy Carter qualified that by saying that he wasn't necessarily hopeful that it would really happen that way. Right. But what is interesting is obviously he has decided to do what Shimon Peres has done, which is, as he says, reach out to your enemies. It is the only way to get anything done.
It's very interesting to watch this whole process and to see how it plays out, because, you know, on the one hand, you really don't want to be empowering people who are just, you know, plain old bat nuts, or who want to destroy you. I mean, I understand Israel's position. On the other hand, if you don't talk with your enemies, then you've lost the lessons of Nixon and China and Reagan and Khrushchev, and for that matter, Dwight Eisenhower, Gorbachev, or for that matter, Dwight Eisenhower and Khrushchev. I mean, we have a long history of talking with our enemies.
Exactly. And I just don't understand why. But I'm also a little disturbed today. Senator Clinton said that she was on ABC this morning. She was asked about what she said about the massive retaliation if Iran were to strike Israel. And she said, well, if Iran were to launch a nuclear attack on Israel, what would our response be? And she said she wanted the Iranians to know that if I'm president, we will attack Iran and basically obliterate them, is what she said.
So, you know, I think that most Americans would not disagree with the sentiment, but I don't think that the Constitution gives the president that unilateral right absent a treaty. Is there a treaty that I don't know about?
Not that I know about, but of course, you know, the power to declare war is clearly in the Congress of the United States.
That's right, yeah.
So, okay, a few other interesting things. There is the National Academy of Sciences today said there's a clear link between short-term exposure to smog and premature deaths. This is the first time they've come out with that. And this is at exactly the same time that several members of Congress, led by Ed Markey, have said that in terms of the cap-and-trade agreements on pollution, that they should not be given away, they should be sold. And that's very interesting, because several Republicans also feel that they should be sold, these pollution credits,
right,
as opposed to just giving them away. So actually there's some agreements with Republicans and Democrats, and I don't know what this latest report from the National Academy of Science actually does to that.
Yeah, the market is being created for it as we speak. I mean, there are businesses and business people who are just, you know, really getting ready for this. So, interesting times. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, their website. A great website, by the way, and photos from our trip to Darfur on the upper left-hand corner there at talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Coming up next, the ambassador to Finland, from Finland to the United States, Pekka Lintu.
Truth in broadcasting.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Talk radio for the rest of us.
So how do you build a nation that works? That actually works, where the quality of life is high, where people are happy, where business gets done, and yet it gets done in a way that doesn't, you know, poison, pollute, contaminate, where growth is a value that is not cancerous, at least in the context of business, where people have basically what they need, where they're what I would say is above Maslow's hierarchy of human needs threshold, above the threshold of safety and security. Pekka Lintu is with us. He's the ambassador of the nation of Finland to the United States. The website finland.org/en for English. And Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being with us. Your nation has a woman as president, Tarja Halonen. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, Tarja Halonen, yes.
Yeah, and she was, in fact, she was just reelected for a second term, second six-year term in January 2006.
Right.
The biography of your nation, I believe this is from your website, says over the last 40 years, Finland has evolved into a true Nordic welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, that phrase, welfare state, is considered a pejorative. Why does Finland not consider it such?
Well, I think that's what people want. Basically, because it means that it's a society that is, at the same time, kind of safe and competitive.
Mm-hmm. How so?
Well, I mean, maybe I go the other way around. I mean, while being a welfare state, we rank among the top countries in the economic competitiveness, in innovation, in research and development. And at the same time, as I said, we are a Nordic welfare state, so it thinks that the model works quite well.
Right. The lifespan of Finns is longer than that of the United of Americans. The quality of life is better. There's all kinds of indicators, ways that you can measure the quality of life. You have in your country three major political parties, the Social Democratic Party, there's a Conservative National Coalition, and the Center Party?
Yeah, those are the three major parties. Then we have some others.
Right. Yeah. And so I'm assuming you have proportional representation there.
Yeah, okay. True. Yeah.
And which we don't have here, which kind of throws us into a situation where we're forced into a two-party state. But to what extent is the social safety net, this very, very healthy and strong social safety net that you describe as a Nordic welfare state in Finland, of cradle-to-grave security, basically? You know from cradle to grave, mm-hmm, that if you are sick, you will be cared for no matter what the circumstances are, that people,
yeah,
in their old age are provided for, the idea of, I mean, half of all bankruptcies in the United States are the result of people getting sick. I'm guessing that the number of people in your country for whom that happens is, what, zero?
Well, the system is different in the sense that we have basically a free health care. And that means that for a kind of nominal amount of money, I mean, you go and visit the health centers and, mm-hmm, you get the care that you need, or you go to the hospital and the same applies.
Right.
So basically it's virtually free.
So to what extent do these three parties, and I'm assuming the Conservative National Coalition would probably be the one, to what extent are they pushing back against this and calling for what Europeans refer to as neoliberalism and what we in the United States refer to as Thatcherism or Reaganomics?
Well, I would say that among these three major parties, the understanding of keeping the welfare state is rather strong. I mean, among
by all three.
Of course, then there are some shades of difference. I mean, how to develop it further. Mm-hmm. I mean, which direction go. And let me just point out, I mean, when we are talking about the free health care, it doesn't mean that everything is provided by the state or by the municipalities. The municipalities or the state, whichever, they are responsible for that everybody gets this health care. So then they can kind of outsource it to private companies, but for the customer, that is the citizen, I mean, it is free and in a way guaranteed by the municipalities.
This is what would be referred to in the United States as a single-payer system,
Well,
by and large?
Well, it's a bit difficult to compare because the whole system is quite different, but I mean, we pay for about 6-7% of our GDP for this,
mm-hmm,
and that's not very much, quite frankly. I mean, for what we get for as a healthcare
is I believe that healthcare is like between 10 and 12% of GDP in the U.S.? Am I?
Well, I think it's a bit more, but I mean, around, I thought it was something like 14.
It may well be. I don't have
something like that, but I mean, anyway, it's...
I know, it's higher than most nations.
Anyway, I mean, but I mean, it's always difficult to completely compare the systems. Yeah. I mean, these are the numbers.
We have in the United States groups that have that are mostly funded by very wealthy families, people who have inherited wealth in large part, or whose families are representing very, very large corporations, who have funded these a variety of very conservative think tanks that suggest, and in some cases libertarian think tanks, that suggest that the government really should play no role whatsoever in healthcare, in education. I'm assuming, by the way, that people can get a college education in your nation regardless of their family's economic status. And this kind of thinking, particularly since Reagan became president, has become accepted by Americans. Even if not embraced by Americans, I'd say the majority of Americans don't actually embrace it, but it has been accepted as mainstream thinking. I'm guessing in Finland, this kind of thinking would be considered radical or extremist.
Well, I don't know how to call it, but let's say that there's, as I already mentioned, quite a strong feeling among the voters and political decision makers that this is a system, the Scandinavian welfare state, Nordic welfare state, is the basic model that we are quite happy with, and we pay higher taxes, but I mean for that we get more, like daycare for kids, healthcare for everybody, and free school and university, and in a way, I mean that means some kind of stability for people who are planning to have a family, or I mean in their life in general, because they won't get these rather big surprises which can be very bad for their economies.
Right.
I mean they know that okay, they pay this much tax and then this is what they get.
Right. Sir, we only have a minute or so left. I'm sorry, but we're speaking with Pekka Lintu, the ambassador from Finland to the United States. As the ambassador of the United States, you live here or you spend a lot of time here.
Yes.
You are a keen observer of the United States. How do you respond to folks who say, well, that's fine for Finland. That's only 5 million people. That's smaller than New York City, and it's a largely homogenous population. And, the United States is a very different country. That would never work here. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that's a fair point. I mean, the differences in size and tradition are of course, quite different. I'm not trying to kind of offer ours as a model. I'm always.
Well, I'd like to take it as a model. I think it's a great idea.
Well, I mean, I'm always glad to discuss it, but I also understand the basic differences.
How would the United States implement something like what you have?
I think that first you have to really see the difference in size, because that means that governing a system of 5 million, 5.5 million. People is different from 300 million. I mean, and we have a unitary state. We don't have a federal state. So that already makes it quite different.
Right. In other words, we have 50 states. You have basically one state that is also the one nation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly, which is rather homogeneous also. I mean, the people are either Finnish or Swedish speaking and have very much the same origin.
Mm-hmm. So, So I guess we have a few more challenges, but it seems that we should be able to look to Finland and say, hey, there's something going on there that we need to learn about.
Well, as I said, I'm always glad to discuss it, and I find it interesting to talk to people here and also kind of taking their ideas of our system, what we could do.
Yeah. Pekka Lintu, the ambassador from Finland to the United States of America. Finland.org is the website, /EN for the English language version. Ambassador, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Very good speaking.
Thank you. Bye.
You're welcome. Thank you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 866-303-2270, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com. Let's talk about the election for a few minutes here.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Now I still stand home, watching TV.
866-303-2270. Tom Hartman here with you. Annie in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Annie, what's up? Annie?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. My comment was about the divisiveness that you feel is going on, but it's such a pleasure to have you have the ambassador on who can speak extempore about things. People in Europe really know and can deal much better with politics and a real conversation than we do here in America because our treatment is so superficial. Thank you for what you do for us.
You're welcome, Annie. Thank you. And also, I think, you know, it's worth noting that most European countries have a strong, either strong laws that require the corporate media to provide actual news, or they have a strong national news service like the BBC that most Americans are familiar with. And
I listen to the BBC at night, and
yeah.
When we lived up in Bellingham, Washington, I listened to the Canadian radio.
Yeah, and I still watch BBC, and when we lived in Montpelier, I used to watch CBC, and the fact of the matter is, here in the United States now, ever since, you know, Archer's Daniel Midland was outed and ended up paying a $300 million fine because of an investigative report by NPR, basically since that time, I think that was about 10, 15 years ago, now I'm seeing as many ads or hearing as many ads on public broadcasting, and I'm not hearing any more investigative reporting, thank you very much. And it's just, you know, it's like we've lost the whole thing from the public spectrum all the way to the private spectrum in the United States. It's a tragedy.
But it's very sad. But what I wanted to say about the divisiveness, I'm not here to be accusative, but the fact is I had to quit listening to one after the other of Air America's hosts. Randy Rhodes, she would just have people on who
yeah.
were serious.
And Annie, I get your point. I really don't want to discuss other people's programs on this program. I'm sorry. It's just, you know, like, ain't going to do it. Mike and but I get it that, you know, whatever. Mike in Michigan. Hey, Mike. Thanks for listening to WDTW there in Detroit. What's up?
Hey, thanks, Tom. I wanted to just briefly kind of address what a previous caller said about the divisiveness and the dirty tactics of Barack Obama as it related to his so-called praise of Ronald Reagan and the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised that you let her walk away with that statement without challenging at all. Well, first thing I wanted to say is that...
Hang on just a second. What was the statement again? I missed.
She made a statement that Barack Obama, she was giving some examples of him
right.
being below the belt.
Right.
And he talked about the statement that he made that Ronald Reagan was a transformational president.
Yeah, and I said to her, he was. He transformed this country in a terrible way.
But the thing is, you said I'm not going to debate you. But I just wanted to just briefly throw out a couple of factual statements
okay.
about that.
Sure.
This whole phenomenon of red states and blue states is fairly new. Ronald Reagan won 49 out of 50 states. The one state that he lost, which was Walter Mondale's home state, he lost about 4,000 votes. That's a fact. Secondly, the party of ideas. The contract with America, which was a bad idea, was a group of ideas. Look what they produced for the Republicans. They gave them the House back for the first time in 40 years. They won 12 governorships, 54 net seats in the House.
Yeah, these are the benefits of packaging. No, I get it. And what Newt Gingrich did and Frank Luntz did was brilliant. I mean, I wrote a book about this called Cracking the Code. Brilliant communications. They did good old-fashioned Procter & Gamble 101 marketing and packaged and what's amazing is if you go back and you look at the contract on America, out of those 10 points, 6 of them, if you drill back into the legislation that Gingrich is pointing to, 6 of the 10 were tax cuts for the rich.
And the last point that I wanted to make is that when Barack Obama made that statement, and this is when you talk about dirty tricks, here's Bill Clinton paraphrasing what he said. I disagree with Barack Obama saying that the Republican was the party that had all the good ideas. He never, ever said. That's a blatant lie.
Right.
And then the other thing I was going to say is this. How can you dispute the fact that, and this is the last part, Bill Clinton, as a result of this, who never won 50% of the vote, he won 43% the first time, 49% the second time. He starts off the next State of the Union address. This is a fact. The era of big government is over.
Yeah. Well, this was
over because he was beaten by the Republicans.
No, it's what happened, and I forget which book it is. We had the author on for 6 months ago or so. But Bill Clinton in '92 ran as a progressive, and after the election, but about a week and a half, 2 weeks before he was inaugurated, he was sat down with Alan Greenspan and
it wasn't Robert Reich, it was Robert, I think it was Robert Rubin, sat him down and said, Bill, we know you ran as a progressive, but we're going to tell you the facts of life.
Well, last thing I wanted to ask this question, I mean, this is about the election as well. There's two different ways you can look at it. To me, the Clintons have a strategy to win, and you can subsegment the population, get demographics, turn them against each other, and you can win. You can demean a person, demoralize them, dehumanize them to a point where you can win, but it's not an effective strategy for governing. So when a lot of Democrats say that the goal in November is to win, I disagree. The goal is to govern. And you cannot govern if you tear people down the way that they're doing to the point where when it's time to govern, they're not going to join hands with you.
Mike, it's brilliant. You that was an absolutely brilliant statement, and I absolutely agree with you. Thank you so much for calling and sharing that with us. Yes, spot on. And we need somebody who can govern and who can govern well. It's rare that I'm speechless. I'm really impressed. 27 minutes past the hour. Jim Hightower coming up next.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
6-6-3-0-3-22-70. I've been getting a pile of emails from folks going, holy cow, this ballot in Pennsylvania doesn't have Barack Obama's name on it. People are absolutely freaked out. It's not a ballot. It's not even a sample ballot. It's an advertisement. It probably has to do with the lack of walking around money, as it were, but, you know, that's a whole other argument. But basically, yeah, because there's photos of this thing all over the web, and it looks like a ballot, and it has Hillary Clinton's name up at the top, number two, and it doesn't have Barack Obama's name on it. That's because, and it's taking, you know, and it's recommending individual candidates, and it's recommending voting on particular positions because it's an advertisement. It's something that forever political campaigns have done these. They make them look like ballots so that when people get in and see the real ballot, they'll say, oh, yeah, now I know what it looks like. Here's where to vote. So you can calm down the emails to me. And anyhow, Jim Hightower is with us, national radio commentator, writer, public speaker, author, former twice-elected Texas Agriculture Commissioner. JimHightower.com is website. One of my all-around favorite people and one of the most articulate spokespeople for the progressive movement. His new book out, Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tommy. Great to be with you.
It is great to have you here. Tell us about your new book, Swim Against
the Current. It's really about the plucky spirit of the American people. You know, we're not the centrist, go-along-to-get-along, salute the commander-in-chief, march to the corporate order sort of folks we're portrayed by the media and politicians to be. Instead, we're a bunch of mutts and mavericks. That's who you are. That's who I am. That's who founded this country and what makes this country great. And so my co-author, longtime co-conspirator Susan DeMarco and I kept, as we traveled the country, meeting all these ordinary folks who are doing so many extraordinary things in business, in politics, in healthcare, religion, banking, all aspects of our lives. And so we decided we should tell some of these stories, not only to celebrate those folks, but also to inspire others to turn loose that same spark within them.
For example?
Let's take one in business. A guy here in Texas, he's a pharmacist. Chris Johnson is his name, making six figures working at a corporate drug chain, doing well, climbing that corporate ladder. But he said, it just made me sick to my stomach. And what made him sick was people coming up and getting their prescriptions filled, but then when he presented the bill, they couldn't pay it. And as a corporate functionary, he had no authority to say, well, hey, this is for your health. You got to have it, so let's work something out. So he spun off and created something called MedSavers, a model pharmacy. that caters to people who have no health insurance. And because he doesn't have to deal with those bureaucracies of the insurance empires, he's able to take a bottle of pills that he would have sold for $59 at the corporate chain, and instead sell it for $16 and make a profit.
Isn't it a crime, though, that we're that's an opportunity?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, wait a minute. But nonetheless, you're right. Taking the disasters of Reaganomics and libertarian philosophy and the whole conservative economic mess that they've created for us and turning it into something you make money with, I guess, you know, hey, we have to salute that. I mean,
you're talking about people's health. You know, this is not a gizmo.
You know, in a way, actually, this is what you and I are doing. You know, I mean, if these guys weren't so crazy, you wouldn't be writing these books. I wouldn't be writing my books. I wouldn't be doing this radio show. So,
exactly. Well, it makes good material for us.
There you go. Yeah,
and that's what we want to do, Tom. And this book was, instead of saying, well, here's another story about how bad things are, well, here's some stories about people who are actually doing something about it. You know, in politics, and this is something you've talked about, but the powers that be teach us, oh, well, you can't do anything about the corporate corruption, the buying of politicians and buying of government policy. That's just the way the system works. Well, in Maine and Connecticut and in North Carolina, where I just was last week, out in that left-wing state of Arizona, you know, people are doing things about it. They're providing public financing of their elections.
Yep.
And with dramatic results. In Maine now, they have 83% of their Senate, 84% of their House elected without taking a dime in corporate money. It's just changed the politics. And that came not because some politician stood up, but because ordinary people stood up and forged coalitions, and either by initiative or going through the legislature, put that alternative into law.
Well, and to a large extent, haven't the major advocates of public financing of elections and of instant runoff voting, which is another way to make voting more democratic, it's in over 300 communities around the United States, haven't the major advocates of that been the Green Party? You know, outside the tradition, Green Party and independents, people who are not affiliated with the Democratic and Republican parties?
Yes. Many people would think the Democrats would be in the lead of that since they don't win the money battle, but no. In Massachusetts, for example, the people passed a public financing alternative, but the Democratic legislature there refused to fund it. So they killed it. But people keep coming back and demanding these kind of reforms that actually work.
Yeah. And what are the reforms you're seeing on the horizon, Jim Hightower?
Well, one's right there in your area of Oregon, great bunch there called the Oregon Bus Project, provided some leadership.
These Jefferson Smith and his merry band.
Yeah, there were 20-somethings back in late 2001, dismayed by the outbreak of right-wing nutballism that was taking place in the legislature there. And to make a long story short, really a wonderful story short, they abandoned themselves into a 1978 cruiser bus and caravans going out into suburban swing districts where some of these Republicans were getting elected with 200, 300, 400 votes and volunteering for good candidates. Just going door to door on their own. No campaign managers, no consultants, no paid advertising, no robocalls, none of that.
No, I keynoted their conference a few weeks ago.
You know that good bunch.
And
they turned it around. You know, they didn't do it by themselves, but they could well have made the difference in switching both houses of the legislature in only three election cycles.
Yeah, I think they've had a huge... Well, it's great that you are out there documenting it. Jim Hightower, your marvelous new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go With the Flow. People need to check it out. Jim, thanks so much for all the great work you do, for your ongoing voice on the radio, for the books that you're writing. You're the Energizer Bunny of this movement, out there constantly, all over the country.
Well, right back at you, Tom. Yeah. I'm really, really pleased to be associated with all this great progressive movement that's building across our country.
Amen. Thanks so much for being with us. Jim Hightower, his new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go Against the Stream. And Jim Hightower, great guy. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Dennis in Felton, California. Hey, Dennis, what's on your mind today?
Dennis Holt.
Dennis, you are on the air.
Yeah, well, how do you do? My name is Dennis Holt, and I'm glad to get in. I'm running for Congress in the 14th District here of California.
on a Peace Corps banner kind of ticket against our current representative, Anna Eshoo. I went to her town hall meeting last October 13th, and she was hoodwinking the people.
Is she a Democrat or Republican?
She's a Democrat, but she doesn't understand either the nature of impeachment or the nature of gerrymandering, and I called her on both points, and I told her right there on that day, I'm going to run against you, ma'am, and I'm doing it.
So you're running on a separate party ticket. You're not running in a primary against her.
That's right. We're going to have to do a write-in campaign. We have a national organization in a different manner. I've been running for president in kind of a clandestine way since March 23rd, 2003, after I got fired from the University of Montana for speaking out against the war. You can all check this out on the Internet.
Sure. So, Dennis, I got it. Why don't you give us your website, and we'll consider this a political plug, and I got to move on to the next caller. But your website is?
We just put it up on YouTube, and it's Peace Force 13 and or Orphic Koans and Teriyaki Tacos. We got the first two of about four that we have readied, and that's how it's going.
Great. Sounds like a plan. Dennis, thanks a lot for the shout, and good luck. Good luck. I don't know you. I don't know your politics, but I always think it's great when people run for political office. David in Oregon. Hey, Guy. David, what's up?
Yeah, Tom. I've listened to Top Talk Radio a long time, like on the West Coast. I was born in Michigan. I think we might have crossed paths in Lansing at one time. But anyway, I'm calling about the lady that called up and said that she would, her and her husband, if it was Hillary, would vote for Ralph Nader. Do you remember?
I do.
Now listen, and then she used the excuse, and this is Ralph Nader's, that if things got to get really bad. Well, what is really bad? You know, when our forests are all cut, all the old growth, and the rivers are all dammed and whatever, then will we all vote for Ralph Nader?
I'd say it's really bad right now, if that's your point, David. And that's the thing. I'm getting emails from people on both sides saying, that's it. No more. You know, if it's Hillary Clinton, I will not. Or if it's Barack Obama, I will not vote for a Democrat. And I'm like, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Don't you realize what's going to happen if you have John McCain appointing the next Supreme Court justices? It's like, wait a minute. So, it's the price is too high. I'm saying this as a guy who in the 2000 election, Louise and I had a long talk about this. We lived in Vermont. We knew that state was going to go for Al Gore. There was no doubt in our mind. And I wanted the Green Party in large part because of their work with instant runoff voting around the country and popular funding of elections. I wanted them to have that threshold where they would get matching funds. And so Louise voted for Al Gore, who I supported, and I voted for Ralph Nader. So here's a guy who's voted for Nader saying, no, we can never do that again. Sorry. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Some of us out there working to bring it back and make it free again. One of them, Congressman Earl Blumenauer from Oregon, blumenauer.house.gov, the website. And Congressman Blumenauer, first of all, welcome to the program.
Howdy. Happy Earth Day.
Thank you. And, in fact, the reason to have you on in particular, there's this new committee in Congress that you're a member of, the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. Tell us about this.
Well, the Speaker has made an unparalleled commitment to advance issues that relate to ending the tyranny of imported oil, the threat of global warming, and to have the government lead by example. She created, not without a little bit of controversy, this special committee chaired by Ed Markey. It's got a real terrific lineup of members, old and new in Congress. It was interesting that the Republicans that were selected by the Republican leader It appeared that they didn't want the people who were Republicans that were most deeply concerned about global warming and climate change. They were off.
So instead they picked the obstructionists? My word, not yours?
Well, it's just it's been pretty remarkable in terms of what has happened with the committee, the biases that are being inflicted. But this has allowed the Speaker and the House leadership to focus the spotlight on the need to redirect massive subsidies that go to oil companies, that need to go to emerging technologies. It was a vehicle that helped move things along so that we have the first fuel efficiency standard increase for vehicles in 30 years. And we've passed not once but twice major tax legislation that would have made the energy system more fair and give help to those who need it the most.
So the Bush the other day, and the Bush administration, I know that's a laugh line, but we're talking with Congressman Earl Blumenauer of Oregon. And in addition to being on the Budget Committee, the Ways and Means Committee, he's also on this new Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. And today, of course, Earth Day. Bush, yesterday or the day before, whatever, the administration talking about their goal of let's begin reducing emissions in 2025. Even Arnold Schwarzenegger came out and said, these guys are crazy.
It's truly embarrassing. It's truly embarrassing that we used to talk about being the leader of the free world, not when it comes to protecting the planet and dealing with global warming.
Well, it's beyond embarrassing. I'm beginning to think it's criminal. We have politicians who, in the interests of ExxonMobil, the most profitable corporation in the history of Earth, going back to the Roman Empire, I mean, a $40 billion profit last year. A larger company, actually, Walmart, had sales about $30-40 billion larger, only made a $12 billion profit. I mean, $40 billion profit, yep, from an oil company, and this oil company then is funding these climate deniers who are trying to pretend that there's actually a debate about global,
yep,
warming. I mean,
yep,
at some point, the outrage has to reach some kind of critical threshold and even penetrate the brains of Republicans.
Well, I think we have really reached that tipping point. It's fascinating to me as I work around the country with communities on issues of livability, climate change, and environment, where cities small and large, over 830 now, have said, forget the Bush administration, we're going to be Kyoto compliant on our own.
Well, we did in Portland.
In Portland, we've actually made more progress than any city in the country in reducing greenhouse gases. But there are hundreds around the country. There are college campuses everywhere you go. I'm sure, Tom, you've spoken on several of them, where the students and faculty have gone ahead and made changes there. There are Girl Scout troops and Rotary clubs that get it, just not this administration, its EPA, or its Department of Energy.
Just not the former oil executive president and the former oil executive vice president and the Secretary of State who had a tanker named after her. I mean, gee, what a coincidence. I don't know. I'm just baffled by this. It makes no sense. On a positive note, Arnold Schwarzenegger's a Republican. He's out talking about this. I don't know about Gordon Smith. He seems to become a Democrat for a year or so before the elections, but, you know, without getting too natty about all this, it seems to me that there's a sea change happening.
Yes, you are absolutely
politics.
Right. And there are some Republican voices that they wouldn't put on our special Global Warming Committee, but there's Roscoe Barrett from Maryland, a scientist who takes to the floor regularly talking about the concerns of peak oil.
A Republican.
A Republican. Mm. There are Republican governors that are joining with us in the challenge to this outrage that EPA is standing in the way of California, Oregon, and eight other states in having higher emission standards for our vehicles.
Right.
This is moving forward, and it's one that mercifully on this Earth Day we can say the public is ahead. There are businesses that understand that it's not just good PR, but they're going to make money.
Mm-hmm.
I truly believe
green is the new green.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the bottom line. Congressman Earl Blumenauer, a U.S. congressman from Oregon, representing Portland and environs. Sir, always great talking with you.
My pleasure, friend.
Thanks for dropping by. Tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CMNSnews.com. We're going to be talking about rising gas prices, taxes, the TV's Pentagon puppet military analysts, and, of course, the Pennsylvania primary, and that's just for starters. And investigative journalist Larissa Alexandrovna of Raw Story going to talk with us about Governor Siegelman and a new one, Mississippi Attorney Paul Miner. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.